Actually, a couple of reviewers said that the book defies summary.
Yeah.
I don't so much summarize it as try and touch, when I try to answer the question, what is this book about, I try to touch on some of the themes. And the book is set against the background of the war in Afghanistan and the financial crisis. And it follows two principal protagonists and their each of their respective lives, or their respective lives, I should say. And it carries within it a thread of inquiry about epistemology, about what it is we think we know, what it is we think we can rely on, so I think that's what I say. It's also about other things such as friendship. It's of course about love, and the search for meaning. Here's a general proposition. I did a radio show with Cedric Villani, a French Fields medalist, and what we said was that mathematics is very different from other disciplines in that any claim, mathematical claim, that is proven to be true can never be contradicted. It is different from science, from humanities, in that respect, because once something is established to be true mathematically, it is true for all time. Whereas even a scientific experiment which is repeated 100 times and yields the same result, there is no guarantee that it will yield the same result next time. So that makes it a unique enterprise. But there is this caveat. There is this caveat, and that caveat is Gödel's incompleteness theorem, because Gödel came along and showed that either there are mathematical claims that are true but cannot be proven to be true, or the system of mathematics that we have is inconsistent. Now, inconsistent has a very simple meaning in mathematics. A system is inconsistent if 1 = 2. And he showed that either we will find that there are, well, we won't find, that's the whole point. There are claims that are true, but we can never prove them to be true. We don't know what they are, or the whole of mathematics collapses. And it's uncomfortable to imagine that the whole of mathematics collapses, so we're left with this possibility that there are things that are true that cannot be proven to be true. It is a place of safety for Zaffa. Mathematics... Again, on that radio show, there were two mathematicians for the purposes of the show. I was also a mathematician. My first 2 degrees were in mathematics, and we all agreed that Cedric said that the mathematics was, people describe it as complicated. Mathematicians actually regard it as very simple, in comparison with the claims made about the world. The world is much, much more messy. Things are never very clear. The problems we attack in the world are never very clear, let alone the solutions. But mathematics is different. The problems can be very clearly articulated. Is it true that in a right-angled triangle, the square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares of the other two sides? That's very easy to articulate, that problem. And it turns out that the solution is not at all difficult. It's, in fact, several thousand years old. The solution, the proof that this claim is true. There's an irony. There always has been. People think of mathematics as complicated. The strange thing is, its claims are very simple. And even its proofs are ultimately quite simple. The example I gave you, the proof of that is extremely simple. Zaffa takes refuge in the simplicity of mathematics, the clarity of mathematics, the certainty of mathematics, but then he hits Gödel's incompleteness theorem. And in fact, the novel starts with that. And the metaphor there is that even in mathematics, there is no secure footing. This is devastating for him. Zafar struggles with who he is, what he is. He is lost. He has no sense of belonging. He thought he, and to some extent, tries to find a sense of belonging in the world of ideas. But really, it appears to be more a distraction strategy than anything else. He's rootless. But he's rootless in pretty much every way. So it's not just geography, it's class. He has transcended his humble origins, but he cannot penetrate British upper class. He has a relationship with a woman who is, you know, from the other side of the mountain, let alone the stream. You know, she's completely different class. And it's a devastating relationship. It's a tragic one. And he has this friend, the narrator, who is also from another class. He doesn't seem to find a foothold in the world. He has lived in different places. He's a vagabond. He's a vagrant. He's homeless. That grew out of my own personal experience. But it grew out of my own experience. I mean, the novel emerged from I went traveling in 2007. I quit my job and I went across Europe and Asia, and I didn't really have a specific goal in mind. I wanted to meet interesting people, and I did. I met fascinating people. I searched them out, people who lived on borders in some sense, you know, people who were marginal. So a Greek elderly man in Istanbul, a gypsy whose mother was Saudi gypsy, which is unusual, and father was Bulgarian gypsy, and all sorts of fascinating people. Extraordinary number, and had interesting conversations with them, but my journey was interrupted in Syria when a friend called to say that her mother was dying. I went back, and another friend was having a baby in New York, and I went to visit them and stayed with them, and 3 weeks later the baby died. And I stayed with my friends to be whatever kind of support I could be. This was at the very end, December now, finally, of 2008. And I started writing something, an idea I had formed in my mind while I was traveling, and it was a question: what would I look like to, what would the person at the end of this journey look like to the person at the beginning, but also look like to the person I was 20 years ago when I was a banker. I was a banker a long time ago, and I'd sort of, you know, gone through life in this sort of, moved away from where I started so much. And that was the opening image, really, in a sense. It was a, what happens if I divide myself in two and one side meets the other? The narrator, I would say, is a sort of an aspect of me that appears on paper and has been present throughout my life. People constantly ask me, no, they not ask me, they assume, you know, when I say I left Bangladesh when I was a baby, before I even say anything more, quite often they say things like, your parents were diplomats, or something. And they just make an assumption about my background. And so I know how I'm, you know, how people have related to me, and not always like that. I mean, Britain, that's not the assumption. In Britain, the assumption is, you know, because you're dark skinned, the dominant assumption is you must be a bloody immigrant. So that's how the book emerged. I wrote a chapter and or I was just writing. I met a writer, and I was tinkering with this, or I told him about it. Just he asked me what I was doing with my time, and he kept badgering me. He wanted to read it, and it was very embarrassing because you know he's a proper writer, and I just tinker, and I've been tinkering for 20 years. I've been writing this and that. No thought of publication. I don't. And then eventually, just to shut him up, just to stop my own embarrassment, I sent him the chapter. And then the following morning at 6:30, the phone started ringing, and it was the Wiley agency. So that's how I came into writing a published, now published novel. I finished it, and then we found the buyer, Farrar Straus in New York. And partly because of that, I'm quite naive. I have been quite naive. And one of the things I assumed was that I needn't think about the business side of things, so my agents take care of all of that. The trouble is, you don't learn about the industry and what the industry really wants from you. And so, if I had a choice, I wouldn't have published. If I knew what I know now, I wouldn't have published. Yeah. I know, for instance, that you can't make a living from this.
Okay.
And I've been away from law for more than 7 years, which creates problems for me to go back because you have to retrain or requalify. So it's I'm caught out by that. You can't make a living at all, and the literary fiction. Also, there's most people, literary fiction attracts, because the social status of writers is so high, it attracts people who want social status. So a lot of the people who you see in literature are people who are craving social status. Now you have to think about what that means for the kind of literature they write. And these are people who care about how they look, right? And the ending of my novel suggests that I'm not someone who cares very much about how I look. But I think it's a better novel for it. It has an artistic integrity. It makes sense. It has a coherence. Well, it's the British talk a lot about the Second World War. It's fascinating. I have mental conversations in which, because it's an inconsistency on the part of the British, it's very easy. I mean, if you have any taste for mathematics, you know how to show an inconsistency, and how to lead someone down a garden path. It's an expression. To lead someone up a garden path means they don't realize where they're going to end up. So I have this mental conversation. Someday I might actually use it, because they constantly tell you, you should get past, it was such a long time ago, get past the colonial history, it's time to move on. But if you take a few seconds, you look for a few seconds at daytime television in Britain, basically Adolf Hitler supports, without Adolf Hitler, half of daytime television would disappear. I mean, there is this fixation on the Second World War. I call it a fixation because in comparison with other things that of the same time period. So colonialism is one of them. Colonialism ended long after the Second World War ended. Ghana didn't gain independence until 56. India right after the war. And the fact is that, and then there were atrocities. Millions died in the Bengal famine, because of redistribution, because Churchill, and the records show it, Ted Churchill denied Bengalis food and redirected it to the war effort. And his comments, written comments, are, who cares if a few million Bengalis starve? So the British have completely ignored their colonial history, and yet they haven't, because the effects of that, You can't come away after 200 years of that unscathed. Your own psyche is corrupted. You have built into your culture an attitude towards immigrants, towards foreigners, towards post-colonies that you can't eradicate unless you acknowledge it, unless you look it in the face. And you see that in all sorts of ways. You see it in just the disdain that with which the British hold foreigners. And dark-skinned foreigners, predominantly. But America doesn't have that. You know, America is a land of immigrants. You can understand that, how the history of... I mean, that's the big difference between Europe and America. By the way, it's true of France, I'm sure, and it's certainly true of Netherlands. I spent a couple of months in the Netherlands when I talked about the British in this way, the Dutch... people from Dutch ethnic minorities contacted me and said I was wrong. I spoke at a TV political show, and they said, Netherlands is just as bad. So I think it's a colonial legacy just to look at the post-colonies with this kind of disdain. It was the only way to maintain it, right? The only way to justify colonialism psychically is to say they are better off because of us. That they are, but by being their colonial administrators, we are helping them. And even today, you when a TV show, you know, Britain regularly has these TV shows, documentaries looking at India, and inevitably they examine the same things. The British left a railway system, the various buildings. And of course, they never stop for a moment to ask the question, would those have been built anyway? Because there are lots of countries that have built railway systems and, you know, developed without any kind of colonialism. It's happened all over the world. Moreover, the railway system is a pretty cocked up one because it was built not to service the local population. It was a railway system to transport manufactured goods to the ports. So it doesn't even run. I mean, I'm getting down to the level of detail only because it does make me angry. And here's the thing, the academics agree. There's an academic consensus view of colonialism. Yet, when the BBC or the British talk about it in the newspapers, they always ask a couple of academics. I mean, it's literally a couple of academics who are famously pro-colonialism or always provide a positive spin on colonialism, Niall Ferguson and Andrew Roberts. But the academics think these two people are bogus academics. They think they're very mediocre on this subject. You know, Andrew Roberts is a laughingstock of academics. So there is this kind of program. It's basically because the British people can't stomach it. They would rebel against it violently. They would find it very difficult. It's a comedy when the British Prime Minister goes to India now he'll take in tow a business entourage, and because it's not, you know, it's about business always. And when he goes there, he is a supplicant. He goes there with his hands open, begging, really. But the British media never show that to the British people. And you go to the Indian media or other media and you'll see those images and you'll see what was said. And he can't do that. And he goes there and he tells them, send your students. But at home, he tells the British public, we're clamping down on the number of students that we're allowing from India. So it's because the British public have been trained to regard themselves in a certain way. They have an overinflated sense of their own worth. I mean, you see it now in Brexit campaign. You see all of that played out in the Brexit campaign. And eventually, you know, the reality and the self-image, you know, they're so far apart already. At some point, it just will become untenable. It will reach a breaking point when, I mean, it is beginning to do that already. I mean, it's quite galling to a lot of Brits that India is this now economic giant. It's sort of, they don't understand. And of course, you see lots of Indian students, huge numbers, move to the US. You look at, you know, the head of Pepsi Cola, the head of Google, the heads of, you know, a dozen major corporations in the US, and the powerhouses of American industry are graduates of Indian universities and have these Indian accents and all of that. The idea of a major business person in the UK having an Indian accent, or a major person in a business person in France having a DRC accent or something, this is untenable. You just can't imagine it. People would think there's something weird going on here. In America, it's no problem. When I was a boy, I tape recorded newsreaders because the British are stuck up about accents. Even today, you know, it's very hard to find a newsreader with a Brummy accent or something, you know, a strong regional accent. They're trying to make, you know, bring in more, but it and people judge you by your accent hugely. And in America, it's not the same. You get, you know, I mean, George Bush with a Southern accent became president. Yeah, you can't without losing your own identity. But no, you can't even you can't lose your own identity, because an integral part of the identity is where you came from, and there are umpteen ways in which that is signaled. You can't completely eradicate it. And here's the thing: why would you want to? I mean, again, in the United States, you don't have to. It's the story of the American dream. Is the story of starting with nothing and becoming something. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing that every president, Hillary Clinton has a problem with this, she can't do this, but every president somehow tries to represent themselves, himself or herself, every candidate, as emblematic of the American dream. You know, my grandfather came to the United States, so if it can't be him, you know? And so there's a different value system, entirely different value system about where you come from and where you're going. You know, it's they care about the slope. You know, Britain doesn't, and it's ossified. It's remarkable that in the old world you have, you know, people from the cabinet in Britain is dominated by Etonians. I mean, that's just strange. It is more than strange. And the funny thing is, when you criticize or when you raise this criticism, the response you get is, oh, you're being classist, which is hilarious because it overlooks the point about class, which is entirely to do with power. I went to Oxford, I went to Cambridge, Yale, yeah, and I knew people from every class and know people from every class, and I'm very aware of it and very alive to class difference and to the ways in which we signal our class. I mean, I was thinking the other day, it's a fascinating point. There's much less showing off in the British culture. It's frowned upon, right? But there's a reason for that. It's because everybody knows through other means what your social status is. Right? And showing off is really about, when people start showing off, most of the time it's about trying to place yourself in a hierarchy, move yourself so that other people understand that this is where you are in the hierarchy. But, you know, Pierre Bourdieu talked about habitus and all these signals that we send out, and Britain is dense in signaling. And the accent is an obvious giveaway, the vocabulary is another one, all sorts of things. The color of the, you know, the salmon pink trousers you might wear, whatever. There are all sorts of signals that show where your station is and your what social status you have. So there's no need for showing off. So there is showing off, really. I mean, there's a famous story about a British author who went to a dinner party, moved to the United States, went to a dinner party, sat next to an American person, an American woman, and the woman turned to him and said, "So what do you do?" And he says, "Well, I'm a writer." He was an extremely successful British novelist. He says, "I'm a writer." And she said, "Have you written anything I might have heard of?" And he said, "Well, I dabble." Now, a Brit hearing those words would know that the man's being modest and would know that there's more behind it. She apparently looked at him and said, "Oh, okay," and turned and talked to the other person. And the story is that he learned that in America you have to just say it. You just say, you know, the signals aren't there. And he wasn't aware until he went to that setting that people were reading these things and that he was doing something that was transactional simply by being modest. It was giving information that he was, you know, So it's a false modesty, but they can't see that it's a false modesty. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So because they rely on the fact that everybody else can read what is being intended, or what even they might not even be aware is intended. You know, they can understand. Yeah. So yeah. So.